Greetings.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty good. How's it going?
Okay, I had to read something real quick. I logged into Skype and it said that my pretty May is going away in 2014 or 2013, December 2013. I'm like, what? I gotta figure out more about what's going on because that's my recording device.
Yeah, that's weird, isn't that? An independent. That's not a Skype product, is it?
No, it's another product that is made for Skype, but they're saying that they're taking it away from the desktop app. They're like stopping it, so I don't know what that means.
Huh. Interesting.
I have to find a new way to record podcasts.
Possibly, yeah, maybe. That's interesting. Huh. Just another thing.
Yep, just another thing.
Another thing to deal with. Well, I believe that this episode is episode 21 of the Retrocast.
Episode 21, and who are you?
I am Hunter Rose.
Hunter Rose. Oh, so I know what you've been reading.
Yeah.
And I am the Joker's daughter, Dula Dent. Which is really Two-Face's daughter.
You have to put on more than just face makeup to get in your costume.
That's right.
You need some falsies. So the Retrocast is now legal. It no longer needs to ask its friends to buy a beer. And a couple episodes from now, it'll start to think that it's been overdoing it and needs to cut back on the alcohol.
There you go.
We'll get there when we get there. I thought since the time that we record one of these days, you know, maybe I'll wait till the 50th episode. I'll make some Bloody Marys.
Oh yeah.
I think we talked about Bloody Marys on a previous.
I don't know episode. If that'd be good in the morning.
Yeah.
Maybe a mimosa.
Yeah. Well, that's the other, like, brunch alcohol is a mimosa.
Yeah.
So, one time, back in the day, I used to work as a painter for a living.
And you used to drink that?
Naturally, we started every day with mimosas. No. One day, you know, so we had an outdoor job scheduled in the summer, and usually, my boss would try to have backups, like for indoor work if it was raining, you know. But he only did what he could, and sometimes, you know, if it was raining and the only work he had for us was outdoors, we just didn't work that day. So that happened one day, and I happened to have a champagne bottle in the fridge for some reason. I can't really remember why, but I know that I had orange juice as well, so I didn't have to go to work, so I just started drinking mimosas by myself. I got drunk in the morning while it rained outside.
Painted the house the wrong color?
Yeah, no, it's good. Yeah, I probably would have if they would have changed their mind and called me into work, but that was some time ago. I think you could tell it was some time ago based on the fact that the story doesn't end with me falling asleep, because if I tried to do that now, that's probably what would happen.
Then you won't remember where you are. Where am I?
Yeah.
Why am I in this room?
Then maybe I would have thought I was at work and just started painting my own house.
Mm-hmm. That's what happens when you drink paint.
Yes. You don't want to do that.
Don't do that, children. Don't drink paint.
Do not drink paint.
Don't sniff paint. Don't eat paint.
Don't eat paint chips off the wall, especially if they're old and made out of lead.
Yeah.
You might be able to. I wonder, you probably could eat some. You could probably eat acrylic paint.
And that's I mean, one. Not, and that's one to grow on.
Yeah, I don't know how much you would grow, though. It can't be that nutritious. But I don't think you'd want to eat large quantities of it. I think I probably ate some small quantities of acrylic paint when I was working. Cause,
you just fall into your mouth and something was crunchy?
Yeah. You know, I'm sure I didn't clean my hands as well as I should have every time I took a lunch break. But... So, yeah, that was fun though. The problem is that if you really want to make a good living, you kind of have to start your own company, and then you're working like all day every day. Like, you know, my boss who owned the company, I mean, he would work during the day, and then his evenings were, most of his evenings were made up by bidding new jobs. And but being on your feet, working with your hands, you know, it was I didn't have to worry about getting exercise because I was on my feet all day, and I kind of enjoyed working with my hands, and there's a little bit of a satisfaction at the end of the job looking at what you did, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Seems like an interesting job. It just seems like you're always having to work. Like, the guy who painted our house, he would work with his daughter. It was just him and he would spend a lot of time prepping. Like, he's known for his, you know, prep and stuff.
Right.
And he did an awesome job. I don't know if he's still painting because he fell off a roof, but it seems like almost a 7 day a week job, you know?
Yeah.
Because even sometimes they're working Sundays to get a job done to go to their next job, because they usually book themselves, and if they run late, they try not to be late to their, you know, other job.
You don't want to be late to the next. Then you get behind and. Yeah, it can be tough. I mean, my boss had problems with his knees, you know, from over the years doing the work. And, you know, for the time that I did it, I enjoyed it. It involves a lot of prep work. I mean, naturally people can afford to have people paint their houses. A lot of the places that we painted were... pretty big houses and people with a lot of money and stuff. So, you know, we did a lot of prep work to make the walls look as smooth as possible. And, but it was good for me. I mean, you learn some stuff like in the process of painting, I learned a little bit about plumbing and this and that, just odds and ends that have helped me out around.
How did that come about? You're painting and in the toilet breaks or?
Yeah. I mean, you work with a bunch of guys and, too many, we don't schedule our dumps properly.
And, it's like working with Daryl at Comic-Con or something.
I learned how to remove a toilet, you know?
Yeah.
So, like, if it gets to the point, like, you know, when you got a bunch of guys, like, if I was working at that hotel that, like, all the guys stayed at Baltimore Con, you know, the four guys in the room, after that, they probably just, you know, hired somebody to come in and just take that toilet right out of that bathroom and put a new one in since they destroyed it, you know?
Yeah.
No, but, it's good to pick up some odds and ends, feel a little bit more useful around the house.
Mm-hmm. That's what I'm not. I just say, come and help me.
Yeah.
I call for help!
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 I clogged the toilet. No, I only do so much. You know, I fiddle with it, and then it gets to a certain point. I'm like, okay, this is going to take me way too long to try to figure it out. And eventually, you get to a point you got to call somebody. But it's a lot cheaper if you can figure out how to do it. But sometimes it's not worth it. But speaking of Comic Cons, I went to one last Sunday. Just a small little show here in Buffalo.
Yeah, I'm glad to see you survived. You were always getting choked.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a scary moment where I ran into Sith Lord Darth Vader, and he put the Force choke on me, but thankfully he let up. I learned my lesson. He didn't take me out completely. So,
He's an intimidating dude to work for. I bet if you were painting with him, you would not be here today.
No. No.
if you were painting a Star Destroyer, I don't know.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't have made it through that learning curve period. When I started out, I didn't know what the hell I was doing, so I got good over time, but I would have never made it.
Yeah, he doesn't give you much of a chance. You have to come out swinging.
Yep. There would have just been some other painter standing in the background behind me waiting for his turn. He would have stepped up and started painting while I choked to death in the background.
But I am reading like the new Star Wars Brian Wood series, and while it's not retro, it kind of is, because it takes place right after Star Wars, before Empire Strikes Back.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's kind of like a retelling of, like, I don't think it's in canon, but it's like, what if Star Wars ended here and we're taking off with it? And he Darth Vader seems to choke a lot of people, man. I mean, but I think he gets it from the Emperor, you know, like the Emperor does the same thing, so he's like the child of the Emperor,
mm-hmm.
and he expects the best. So when he gets punished by the Emperor, he takes it out on his staff.
Yeah.
Shit flows down fast.
Yeah, and I suspect that after he did it the first time, it just gets more and more easier to do that as go-to punishment.
Yeah.
The dark side. But yeah, that actually, so at the Comic-Con, there was the local, they're called the Northridge, they're the local Star Wars group. It was, I think I actually might have talked about it on the show, that a new guy started at work, and it turned out that he was, he's actually the leader of that group, and you know, Darth Vader, he was the one in the Darth Vader costume, and it's funny because I knew it was him in there, but he has an intimidating presence because he's 6'3" to begin with, you know, and then he was telling me that is when he's in a Darth Vader costume, he's more like 6'8" because his boots add another inch, and then there's about 4 inches of helmet above where his head normally stops. That sounds weird. So he's a pretty intimidating presence. Because I saw him before he got into costume, I was talking to him. He's a super, super nice guy, really nice guy. And then we walked around the con some and came back, you know, to see if he was in costume yet. And I was like, oh shit. I was a little nervous. But yeah, they had some other good. There was a guy that was a snowtrooper, and there was a couple normal stormtroopers. There's a woman in their group that does like New Hope Princess Leia. She's been doing that character for quite some time. So they're like there were some regular people just like doing cosplay around, but they're like the professionals, you know, like they've been doing the characters for a while.
Yeah.
They had their own area where they were taking pictures of people and promoting their group and stuff. But yeah, it was an interesting con. I mean, it's for the most part, it feels like your average small local con, mostly just dealers selling comics. And I didn't really spend too much money. I mean, I looked through some 50-cent boxes and stuff and got a few things, but it's interesting because they do have a little bit of some like artist tables, mostly local. You know, but there is some people walking around in cosplay and stuff. And I think some people are just coming for that reason. Like they're not really shopping for back issues or anything. But the thing is like it's from like 10 to 5. But if you're only going there to walk around in your costume and stuff, they don't have any panels or anything set up. So there's really not anything to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's nowhere to like eat in the hotel, so you kind of have to leave if you're hungry. And it's just, I don't know, it'd be interesting to see
weird that a hotel doesn't have that.
Yeah,
because it's just weird because I went to a really small toy convention, but you could still go to the bar and they were serving food. Do you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, I think, well, maybe, I don't know, there was a bar there, so maybe they were serving food at the bar. Didn't really look like it. I could be wrong, but regardless, I mean, you know, it was cool. I mean, there were some people with some pretty decent costumes. There was a girl dressed up as like a female Thor, and her costume was pretty good. And there was a Storm walking around, and her costume was pretty simple, but it was effective. And a few others. There was a guy, I mean, his costume was pretty simple because it was like he had just used like that Court of Owls mask that you can get.
Mm-hmm.
And he just was wearing a suit, but he was pretty creepy when he put the, most of the time he had the mask up, but when he walked around for a little while with the mask down, it was pretty.
Yeah.
Those Court of Owls masks are pretty creepy.
They are.
But,
emotionless and dark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, and there was a Harley Quinn. She was walking around with she had a big, huge mallet. But I managed to avoid being hit by it, thankfully. I didn't get knocked out or anything.
Yeah, my Harley Quinn chewed on my Wonder Woman bombshell statue box this week.
Yeah, I saw that on Facebook.
Yeah. She destroyed the box. Luckily, the statue's intact.
Yeah. I've yet to pull the trigger on any of those statues or anything like of that price point, but those bombshell statues are so cool looking because I love that like retro pinup style.
Yeah, 40s type style. Man. That's awesome.
Yeah, those are so cool.
Yeah. The only thing I really didn't like about, well, I guess I do like, I do like that they did this, but there's a reason I don't like it is they seem to ship, like, even though I like pre-ordered them, like, okay, here's 1 month and then the next month and then the next month and then the next month. So that should have 4 months. They shipped them all like in the course of 1 month.
Oh, wow.
Well, except for Harlequin, but I have the Wonder Woman, Poison Ivy, Batgirl and Supergirl statues. And I just haven't had time to plan on where to put them.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's weird. They're usually spaced out.
Yeah, and it's weird because Harley's got this thing where if things are a little different, she'll destroy what's different. And I was like, I don't think she'll touch that. But I rolled the dice. It was my fault.
Mm-hmm.
I trusted her. And I knew that. I knew I shouldn't have, because in the back of my mind is I should probably put that in the other room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well,
just the box.
I always forget too. I always forget you know, I have my bag that I take to work. I always forget. Like if I got a bagel or something like that, even if I leave the bag that it came in my bag, in my work bag. If we go somewhere and Luna's annoyed that we left her alone, she'll start sniffing around the house looking for something, and I'll come home and that bag will be taken out and like torn to pieces because she liked like whatever crumbs she could find.
Yeah, you got to know these things.
Yeah. It was like, the worst was back before I used to live here and. Like I brought my work bag and I had left these pretzels in there that were jalapeno flavored. And we went somewhere and we came back and she had gotten into those, but because they were, you know, jalapeno flavored, we looked at her water bowl was completely empty. So she got a little.
She's like, these are hot.
There. She's like, oh shit. Oops.
Did it help condition her or not really?
I don't know, not really, probably. I don't know if she must have still got some enjoyment out of it. But she's pretty good about it usually. I think she just gets, she doesn't like being left at home.
Oh, yeah.
But, the only other thing I was going to mention about the con was, one person that was more of a known name creator was Graham Nolan was there because apparently he lives like 20 minutes from here. So he was there doing. I didn't end up getting anything from him, but he was doing. He had a print of. He had a print of Batman or Bane by himself, and then he had a print of Batman and Bane that he was signed, and he also had like some of his other stuff that he's been doing for sale.
He did draw around the time that Bane got his. I mean, Bane broke his back, right?
Yeah, he was. He's actually credited as one of the creators of
Bane.
Yeah, and he was the he was the main penciler, I think, on Batman during Nightfall. Because it was, because it was crossing back and forth between Batman and Detective Comics.
Yeah.
And I didn't really notice, but he has done a little bit of work again for DC recently. He did the pencils on the Bane issue in Villains Month, and he was doing pencils on Blackhawks, for as long as that lasted.
Mm-hmm.
He's done a little bit here and there for DC more recently, but he has a. I guess he has an online comic, and he does some syndicated comic strips, stuff like that. So, but I think he was actually kind of the guest of honor the previous year, just because he's
in town and
yeah,
but, everybody knows his name. Like Cheers.
Yeah. It'd be cool. We're close enough to Toronto. It'd be cool in the future if they could maybe get big enough that they could attract some Canadian creators. Like I know Jeff Lemire is up that way, and Toronto's a pretty big city. And I mean, technically, it's only an hour and a half away or so, or like just short of 2 hours. It's just that sometimes the border crossing can add time to your trip.
Yeah.
Yeah, but so. Anyways, you want to get into some comic talk here?
Sure. What do you want to do first?
I can't remember what we did to it last time, but I guess we could start out with we could save Kirby for later, maybe. I think.
Sure.
Last time we did Kirby first. I don't know.
That sounds good to me. Well, do you want me to start?
Yeah, you can kick off.
All right, I read Bat Family number 9, and I remembered this as a kid, like buying this off the spinner rack, and I must have traded her away. And it's incredible how much I remembered from it, because it's from 1977. But it features the Joker's daughter, and who's not really the Joker's daughter, but she's Harvey Dent's daughter, and she looks normal. But Harvey Dent is Two-Face and a criminal, whereas she doesn't have two faces, and she doesn't seem to want to be a criminal, although in this book you couldn't tell, because she tries to do like a Tim Drake on Batman and try to discover who Robin is, and she pretty much does. What she's trying to do is break her way into the Teen Titans. As Joker's daughter or Duella Dent, and she at the end of this he kind of considers that, and I think he's going to introduce her to the Titans, and then she shows up in Teen Titans. But the story is about a team up of Barbara Gordon and Robin, and Barbara Gordon at this time she's in politics. She's a congresswoman. And it opens up, she's coming to get an award and at one of the universities, and somebody starts throwing eggs at her and, protesters and stuff. And you think it's related to the the Joker's daughter, but it's not. It's just another political thing that's going on, and Robin's trying to find out who stole her gold plaque. And all of a sudden, the Scarecrow's daughter shows up and has a run-in with Batgirl, and then the Riddler's daughter shows up and has a run-in with Dick, and you get many of the different daughters, Penguin's daughter, all this crazy stuff, and finally you get the Joker's daughter, where she reveals herself to be Dula Dent, and the daughter of Two-Face, and she said she didn't really commit any crimes. She just caused a lot of mayhem, and she paid for that mayhem. Like, she sent money to city council, I guess, and paid for it. But it's a really cool story, because she's manipulating both of them so she can get what she wants. And they eventually find out one of the protesters stole the gold plaque from Barbara. And then it leads into that Teen Titans storyline. It says, check out Teen Titans for the continuation of this story. But at this time, it was like, I don't think Dick and Barbara were romantically involved, but they were like best friends helping each other out. So it was pretty cool. Dick made a mask out of toilet paper or towels because he was unmasked in one of the scenes, when he got some gas to the face and had to go into the bathroom and pull some towels out of the dispenser and made himself a mask. And I remember that distinctively out of when I read the comic, because I tried to do the same thing out of toilet paper and it didn't work so well.
Oh, yes. When you were unmasked?
Yeah, when I was unmasked. And then it has a reprint from Jerry Robinson, from like the Golden Age, from like Batman number 6. I think it was number 6 or number 3. I can't remember. But it's just about Alfred. He's like, Master Bruce and Dick, you guys, and Master. It says Master. Like, he has the accent. It doesn't say Master. It says Master Bruce and Master Dick. He wants to cook him a special meal because they haven't eaten in 1 week, apparently. So he takes off to go buy some unique vegetables and stuff from like a food market or something, and forgets his wallet and gets involved in a crime where he takes out the crime boss, and then he goes back and he takes this one guy with him that's a chef to cook for Master Bruce, Master Bruce and Master Dick. And then the third story featured Blockbuster. That was by Gardner Fox and Carmine Infantino. And Blockbuster's pretty much like a mindless brute who was saved at one point by Bruce Wayne. So every time he sees Bruce, he kind of has a I'll give him a break kind of thing. So the really interesting point in here is that at the very end, they think Blockbuster's forming some kind of weird powers, like to move objects, kind of like Vader and stuff, but he's not. There's somebody else that's doing that, and it turns out to be the Outsider, which is really fascinating, because before I read this, I thought the Outsider was created in Flashpoint and found his way into the New 52. And in the Trinity War, they reveal the Outsider to be the Alfred Pennyworth of the Crime Syndicate Earth. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is this Outsider has links to Alfred Pennyworth, too. So it is like they took upon the past to write current stories. So I always like that. I just wasn't aware of it.
Yeah, I am. I wouldn't have been otherwise myself, or I mean, even known that the Outsider was, because I'm keeping up to date with the new DC stuff anymore. But I did hear on a podcast they were talking about the old Outsider.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm trying. I can't remember why Dwella Dent. Is there a reason? I'm trying to remember the reason that she dresses up like the Joker instead of, even though she's actually Two-Face's daughter.
I don't think she stated up front here, but she has like a hatred for her father.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, there's a conversation that goes in here. He says that now, I suppose you'll tell Two-Face, your father, what's going on. And he goes, are you kidding? My father's hated me since the day I was born. That's why Mama left him. And he's like, he hated you because he wanted a son? And he said, no way. He hated me because he wanted twins. And then he asks her, why all the villain nonsense? And she says, I want to be a superheroine to make up for the evil my father's done. And he says, you a superheroine? What about all the crimes you committed in the daughter disguises? And then she just said, you know, I've sent money orders to pay for all the damage I've done. And she wants to be in the Teen Titans. But she never says why she took the guises of the many daughters. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Maybe we find that out in Teen Titans.
Yeah, because she does actually end up in that original Teen Titans volume towards the end, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. What are the... So is she the one that's dressing up as Scarecrow, Riddler, and Penguin's daughters, or those are their actual daughters?
Yeah, yeah. She's okay. Dressing up as all of them.
Okay, and it's just the Joker's one that... That stuck at the end,
yeah.
Yeah.
At the very end. And I guess she just kept it, which is kind of a weird thing because the Joker's a lunatic.
Right.
And if you're trying to be a superheroine, why would you choose to the guise of a lunatic?
Right.
So, yeah.
Does her costumes as the other supervillain daughters, they basically just kind of the same thing? They look like female versions of those villains.
Yeah. A matter of fact, Robin mistakes the Riddler's daughter as a dude. He's like, it's the Riddler. He says, no, I got tits. No, I'm not the Riddler. I'm a Riddler's daughter.
That's so funny. So I was just about to say that, like, a female Riddler would look kind of cool.
Yeah.
But interesting.
She's a pretty good fighter, though, because there's one splash panel, or like half a page, where it shows the fight scene between her and Barbara Gordon, and they're it's pretty equally matched. For every mm-hmm. shot that Barbara takes, a bitch slap she takes, the you know, she gives as much as she receives.
Mm-hmm.
But every time she unmasks herself, the Joker's daughter is underneath it. So if she pulls off her Scarecrow mask, the Joker's daughter's there.
No. Weird.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Well, so I'm guessing that because you recognize the name Hunter Rose, that you have read some Grendel before.
I have read some Grendel, but not a lot.
Yeah.
So I've jumped in and out, and I think when I got into Grendel, or the few issues that I read of Grendel were the Dark Horse, you know, like when Dark Horse was publishing new series
mm-hmm.
in the 90s, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I never read any of the old Grendel. And I didn't know, I can't remember if a female was the Grendel at the time that I read it.
Yeah, I really am not familiar with the character. I don't really know much about Grendel. Though I have read some Matt Wagner stuff, and I do like Matt Wagner, who's the creator. The reason what I actually read was the first half of the Batman Grendel trade paperback, which this has. There were two Batman Grendel series. And I think these are from the 90s also. They're about like 3 or 4 years apart. They're both two issue series for a total of four. And they're both, they're all like 48 page issues. So this trade has both of them. I've had this actually for a whole year or so, because I think it's Things from Another World that does the Black Friday sale, and I picked this up in that. And I've just been trying to grab some of the stuff that I've had sitting around and actually read them.
The dent and damage thing that they usually have?
Yeah.
Or they have stuff on Black Friday, too?
Yeah, they have a pretty big Black Friday sale that some of it's dent and damage, some of it's just stuff that they're clearancing out.
Isn't Things from Another World owned by Dark Horse? I think there's some relationship to Richardson.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, that could be. I never heard that, but yeah, I'm not sure. but I remember hearing people talking about the sale 2 years prior after the fact. So last year I grabbed some stuff for really cheap, and this was one of them. And I started to read it one other time and didn't get into it, but I managed to this time and read through the first half of it, the first miniseries. And I think why I had a little bit of a difficulty getting into it the first time was essentially there's four characters here. Obviously, two of them are Batman and Grendel, and then they're contrasted with two women who are roommates. And right from the very beginning of the story, it's constantly switching back and forth between all four of them. So there's kind of, you know, there's four things happening at once, to varying degrees. You know, sometimes panel by panel, sometimes, you know, you have like a sequence of a page or a page and a half before it flips over to the other character. And over time, as the characters become more and more involved in each other's stories, this effect lessens. But each one of the characters' captions are done in a different style to sort of reflect their personality. Like Grendel, this is a Hunter Rose Grendel. He's a sort of a sophisticated novelist of sorts. So his panels, his captions are done in a cursive style that actually occasionally is a little tough to read. Batman's are done in a like a typed out script, typed out like computer style to reflect his personality. And then the two women also have their own style. One of which,
why is the one hard to read? Is it the font or the color?
It's the font.
Okay.
The cursive font.
See, I hate... I'm going to go off on a tangent. I hate that. Like, I understand the artistic value of trying to change the font, but it's really hard for my brain to... Like, Howard Chaykin did this... I was reading this new graphic novel called Century West, and he tried to do, like, a Russian style, even though the guy was speaking English, to make it known that he was speaking Russian. And I, after a while, I couldn't just read his stuff. It hurt my brain to try to read it.
Yeah, I mean, Grendel's captions aren't too bad most of the time. There was a couple of times where I found myself stumbling over a word here or there. The one female character's captions are, they're almost done as if she wrote everything on a piece of paper, and then the pieces of paper were torn up pasted on the panels. So some of them, you know, just kind of some of them kind of run off of the caption box as if it's torn there. It's an interesting effect, but it's sometimes irritating. So, I mean, you have these four different caption styles, especially in the beginning of the miniseries, made it a little bit difficult. I found that maybe it was a combination of me getting used to it, and also, like I said, as the plot goes on and the characters are more involved with each other, They're a little bit more, it's a little less to follow, and a little easier, but, essentially, you know, what's going on is that, Grendel is in Gotham City, and there's a delivery of a Sphinx head, you know, like from Egypt to this museum where one of the women work. And, so she's tied in that way. And then her roommate, also, like works for an art gallery. So on the one hand, the first woman meets up with Bruce Wayne because his foundation is involved in this delivery of the Sphinx head to the city. And then, like Hunter Rose is there, and involved with the other woman because, he has something to do with, or she works for a publisher / art gallery or something like that. So she's supposed to entertain him as he's in town, you know, to work on his new novel or whatever the case may be. But as Grendel, he wants to, like I said, I don't really know a lot about Grendel, but it seems like his whole, shtick is to, kind of be a, I don't know, sort of be like a rogue troublemaker kind of thing. I don't know if that kind of, if that jives at all with your impression or what you've read of him or know of him.
Personally, I don't remember anything of Grendel. I remember it was a female at one point, and as you were discussing this, I went in my database and looked to see if, you know, if I had this, and I did. So, and the fact that I catalog them tells me I read them. So, but I don't remember. I don't remember anything.
I mean, one thing I found kind of interesting was that he chooses a, he wants to make it seem at first as if he's, one of the regular, Gotham villains. And, there's this thought process that he's going through where he rejects, Joker for being too, chaotic, and, you know, he rejects Catwoman and Penguin outright, and, Two-Face for being too grotesque and disturbing, but he likes, the Riddler because of the, quote, literary motif and a history of taunting. So, I would say that he's kind of, that sort of shows his personality somewhat, that he's, he finds the Riddler appealing.
He's Batman, batshit crazy.
Yeah, I mean, he likes that kind of, playfulness of the Riddler, and, but the, but Batman, really isn't fooled for a second, because he recognizes, you know, even though he's trying to imitate the Riddler, he recognizes that it's not the Riddler, because there's some subtle, hints and clues that he's so used to the Riddler and his, the way of operating. Grendel has a plot to deface the Sphinx, and he blackmails, he digs up some dirt on the women in the story and finds out that one of them had a baby and gave her up for adoption. So he finds her daughter and has her kidnapped. And he uses this to blackmail the women into working with him. You know, in the process, he obviously crosses paths with Batman, and it, you know, slowly builds to crescendo with, you know, Commissioner Gordon and the police trying to protect the shipment of the Sphinx into the city, and the women that are being blackmailed by Grendel working against them, and you know, Batman trying to keep everybody safe but also take down Grendel. One thing it also did remind me somewhat is of Frank Miller's style in Dark Knight Returns. There's a use of a lot of those subsequent small panels, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The style somewhat reminds me of that. But you know, I would say that overall, I enjoyed it. The resolution of the story seemed a little bit anticlimactic, but overall, I'm glad I read it, even though I had some
hard time get starting.
yeah, I would say that some of the things that were done for artistic effect were a little counterproductive as far as keeping that balance between artistry and clarity, you know. But overall, it was pretty good. You know, just flipping ahead, it looks like the second miniseries has a little bit of a different style. It doesn't look as dense. I know that's part of the problem. It's just like every page is so full of panels and different styles of captions, and sometimes it wasn't exactly the reading flow from panel to panel wasn't exactly clear. I found myself reading things slightly out of order. And as I'm flipping through the second one, it doesn't look like that will be as much of an issue. It's like the pages aren't as dense and the art style is a little bit different.
Yeah. So you have the hardcover?
I have a trade paperback.
Okay.
And so I basically read half the trade because it's got both miniseries in it.
There's supposedly a limited edition hardcover. It's worth $100.
Wow.
Too bad you don't have that one.
Yeah, especially because I paid next to nothing for this.
Yeah.
I probably would turn that around. I wouldn't be able to resist that, but...
Yeah.
No, this was put out jointly by Dark Horse and DC Comics, and this printing can't be too old. It's not the current DC logo, but it's the one prior to the current one. So 2008.
It's interesting that it says the colorist is Joe Matt.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's the same Joe Matt that does all those crazy shit for Drawn and Quarterly.
Oh, I don't know. The story and the art is Matt Wagner on both miniseries, and then the colorist for the first miniseries is Joe Matt, as you said, and the letterer was Ken Bruzenek, so I guess he's to blame for the confusion somewhat. I don't know.
I guess some people probably appreciate that. I don't. I find it harder to read. They do shit like that in Fables and stuff all the time, and I don't like that.
I can't say as a rule that I dislike it, but it has to be done effectively.
Yeah, I do like the caption boxes when they color them. Like, it's colored to be this character versus this character, you know? I don't mind that. I just have trouble with the fonts.
Yeah.
So, my next book is DC Comics Presents number 34, which features Superman and the Shazam family. This is a continuation from another book I covered, I think, 6 months ago, maybe 8 months ago on this show. I covered 33. And 34 takes off where that one left off, where at the last time we talked about it, Mixoplick and Mr. Mind had formed an alliance to trick Superman and Captain Marvel. So when he said Shazam, he was turning into Superman and vice versa, and they both end up on Planet X through a portal that's through the Shazam Eternity. What is that called? Mount of Eternity? I can't remember what it's called. But, the art is really nice. The art is by Rick Buckler. I think he did the main Superman versus Shazam deluxe edition. And I love his art. It's very much like a George Perez type style. but he's very flexible because in this one it was the Marvel family and he brought in Hoppy, which is a rabbit, which is a more animated style to it. But anytime they punch this guy King Kull, and King Kull is a Shazam villain from the Golden Age. Every time Superman and Shazam punch him, he gains more and more power. And it has to do with magic that Mixleplick is involved with. And Mr. Mind and King Kull kind of do a double cross on Mixleplick. And they're like, well, what are you going to do about it, Mixleplick? If you say your name backwards and get rid of all the magic, then you'll go back to your dimension for 9 months or whatever he's stuck there for every time he says his name backwards. So Mixleplick's in a conflict. He's like, do I let these assholes manipulate me or do I go back to my fifth dimension? So he's in a conundrum. And there's one interesting scene in here where Superman's looking through using his X-ray vision and he's like, he's on Earth-S where the Shazam family are because we have the multiple Earths still. And he's using his X-ray vision, and they're talking about, like, Shazam is like, you had all these extra powers, you know, like heat vision and X-ray vision, and it's like, how do you control it and not be a peeping Tom? And he, like, turns on his X-ray vision while he's talking to Shazam, and he can see a woman taking a shower. She's in a towel, and he goes, maybe I had to turn that off for invasion of privacy, but it's like, damn. But, they're pretty much getting their ass kicked by another robot because the robot is absorbing their powers as they're punching it. So they're kind of pretty much – every time they fight something, they're giving power to either the robot or King Kull. And King Kull is a supervillain from the Golden Age that he was like a Neanderthal that lost all his people. And he wore like a Viking helmet with a skull on it and – he hated humanity and wanted to destroy humanity because he lost all his people were massacred. So he wants to massacre the whole entire world. And this does have the Marvel family briefly in it. So Mary Marvel, Uncle Dudley, and Captain Marvel Jr. And they're trying to fight King Kull while Superman and Shazam are fighting that robot, and then Hoppy appears. He gets ported over, and Hoppy kind of saves the day coincidentally. They think Hoppy punches King Kull, but it's really Mixleplick just saying, like, fuck this shit, you know? I'm going to say my name backwards because I ain't going to take this abuse from these two assholes. And Hoppy takes out King Kull, and then everything's back to normal because they their powers are back, essentially, and every time they punch something, it's not absorbed. And it concludes with... it's weird, because in this time of multi-Earths, the only way that Superman knew that the Marvel family existed is through comics. So Earth-X was like comic books on our Earth. Mm. And the only reason Captain Marvel knew about Superman were... Superman were comics on his Earth. So that's very interesting, and it concludes with Superman reading a story of Hoppy.
Nice. What issue was that again?
This was issue 34, and it was called The Rock of Eternity. I couldn't remember the name of it, but that's right, where the portal is. Mm-hmm. And Shazam, the wizard himself, was kind of unconscious through this whole storyline until Mixleplick said his name backwards and took away the magic. So in reality, if Mr. Mind and King Kull would have played nice, the villains would have won.
Mm-hmm. That's always the way with villains.
Yeah. Egos.
Can't get along with each other. I've been for a while now, you know, reading through the New Teen Titans and the Furious Five were always one of the worst about that with Dr. Light and Simon. They're always arguing amongst each other, and Dr. Light's always trying to take over, and Simon's always like, hell no. That dude was such a... From the beginning, Dr. Light was pretty much of a joke.
Yeah, and then the identity crisis came and changed his life.
Yeah.
Did you read Identity Crisis?
Yeah, and you know, you've said a couple times that's one of your favorites, right?
It is my favorite by far. Like, I was emotionally punched in the gut every freaking issue.
Yeah, I mean, I felt like I got punched in the gut too, but I didn't feel favorably about it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I to this day, I still don't feel good about that miniseries.
I loved every piece of it.
I just felt like it was... The tone of it just seemed forced onto DC Universe. It didn't feel like it was... I don't know. It just felt like they were taking... Like, Meltzer was taking this plot from, from a crime novel and forcing it onto the DC Universe, you know, and like some of the things they, like the topics dealt with just seems sort of out of place for a superhero book, you know.
And for me, it made logical sense because in this Silver Age, what's her name was, the Adams girlfriend was a whack job. I mean, she had some weird shit going on in the Silver Age, so it felt like natural progression that she would be the murderer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a definitely a divisive miniseries. I guess you either love it or hate it, you know?
Yeah.
Probably.
Well, but, they did change the landscape of heroes because the mind wipe.
Right.
There's so much in there to discuss. I mean, it's just... So much happened in it.
Yeah, it's just I just get ugly feelings, and I think of just like the turning Dr. Light into a rapist, and just the Sue Dibney being treated that way, and like I don't know, just feels so.
It was dark.
Yeah.
But we're in a dark world.
Yeah, I guess I wouldn't necessarily like. It's not just the plot elements on their own that. But I guess just the setting of putting it into the DC superhero universe. Just, but I mean, it was. You can count like a number of other things in the years following that were of the same ilk, you know.
Yeah, like Wonder Woman snapping Maxwell Lord's neck and stuff like that.
Yeah, I guess that was just the one that I had the biggest problem with, you know. But, like I said, I think it definitely has its fans, and I know there are other people out there that also kind of felt the way that I did about it. But, yeah, there's a lot there, like you said. Could really get into discussion of a lot of the aspects of that miniseries. But, the other thing I read was Camelot, some more Camelot 3000. Making my way through that. I read issues 5, 6, and 7. You know, I didn't realize from the first four issues there wasn't much to indicate as much, but I guess that this was... miniseries wasn't intended for kids.
Is there nudity?
Yeah, because all of a sudden it's pretty. I mean, at least each one of these issues had some nudity in it.
So it's intended for kids 12 and higher.
Yeah, intended for mature audiences. Morgan Le Fay and Guinevere, I think they're the main ones that. Lose their clothing, but issue 5 deals primarily with giving us some background on Morgan Le Fay. I mean, she's been around in the background in the last few issues, but and we know how Arthur and the Knights have returned to the to the future. But we really haven't got much backstory on her, so she breaks it down for the guy that's the head of the UN, who starts to get a bit, he talks back to her a few times and she smacks him down to let him know that how powerful she is and that she's the one that's in control of their arrangement there. But what it kind of breaks down to, she, goes into the history of the original Camelot and how, she had turned to dark powers to get, the dark arts to get her power, and but found them not to be enough to best Merlin. So she realized that she had to go elsewhere, and she eventually, through, astral projection, discovered a 10th planet, and discovered this alien race that allowed her to, gain these new powers. But at the same time, she's paid a price, and she has these weird kind of boils that are on her back that normally are covered by her cape. When she returned from this planet, she found that more time had passed than on Earth than where she had been, and that's how she finds herself in the future. Meanwhile, the other kind of plot that's going on is that if you remember that Tristan and Percival both find themselves in bodies that they're not too happy with. Tristan finds himself in the body of a woman, and Percival in the body of one of these Neo men that the government uses as enforcers and stuff like that. So they go to Merlin trying to get him to use his powers, but he pretty much brushes them off. So that kind of sets things up later for Guinevere to, or for Morgan Le Fay rather, to approach Tristan with the temptation that if she betrays the knights, that she will return her to a male body. Meanwhile, the other main thing going on is that they have the old Lancelot Guinevere thing, and their temptation to be lovers, despite her being Arthur's queen. Merlin points out that in this incarnation they haven't officially married, and that since Guinevere, prior to her consciousness being reawoken, was a commander in the United States forces, it would be a good marriage for public morale, to encourage people to fight back against the aliens that are attacking. So that goes on, and Lancelot actually supports it and pledges to King Arthur that there won't be any more cheating going on. During the royal wedding, sniper who is trying to shoot King Arthur and take him out actually shoots Guinevere instead, and Lancelot uses his love for her to resurrect her. I think it ends up being issue 7 that regardless of the promise that they had made Arthur, they end up cheating on him again in issue 7, ends it with them being cast out by Arthur for their adultery. Tristan continues to be tempted by Morgan Le Fay to take on her deal. And at the end of issue 7, she also finally ends up, after resisting it, ends up taking on the temptation to agree to betray the knights, because Morgan has kind of put the pressure on by awakening the spirit of Isolde, Tristan's lover, in her body, just as the other, all these other people have been, their spirits been reawakened. And the funny thing is that Isolde's like, she doesn't have a problem with the fact that Tristan's a woman. There's like some, female making out going on, but Tristan's not down with it. She wants to actually be in like a male body again, and part of that desire is what pushes her along to agree.
What is the story of Tristan in King Arthur regular mythos? Because they always use Tristan, like, even in the Shining Knight stuff. Like, mm-hmm. She's a female, like in Demon Knights and stuff. And then you say he, she, so I'm like, it always has that theme. I was wondering in, like, King Arthur days if
there was some kind of...
character based on, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think we need to get Keith Knudsen in on this call.
Yeah, let's see if he's there. No.
And it's phone a friend. I'm not sure. I know that Tristan and Isolde is a famous romance, and I think, did Shakespeare do a version of it? I don't know. But yeah, it's an interesting subplot there, and as I said, Morgan is manipulating a lot of this behind the scenes, wanting to undermine Arthur's group. There's also a pretty big battle, one of the first really huge battles between Arthur and the aliens, which has a cool moment where Percival uses the fact that he's in the body of one of these Neo-Men to actually turn the tide by taking command of the Neo-Men that the forces are using. It's basically what you have going on is that there's the aliens attacking, and while like the United States and other forces are trying to repel them, behind the scenes you have the director of the UN working with Morgan Le Fay to actually allow the aliens to win. So that's undermining Arthur's ability to repel the aliens. The art by Brian Boland continues to be really good. It's just continues to be really, really keeping my attention. I guess it's got the 12 issue miniseries, so I'll talking about it for a couple more episodes here probably, but I've been pleasantly I don't know if surprised is the right word, but I've been
you like to watch two women kiss.
Yeah. I've been pleasantly surprised by
that. Yeah, sure you have.
Like, Tristan, come on. What's wrong with being a lady with another lady?
Yeah, it's nothing wrong with it.
What's amusing is, the kid, Rob, or whatever the hell his name is, that originally discovered King Arthur in the beginning of the story, like, he's still around helping people out, and it's kind of a funny plot line that he's in love with Tristan in her female form, so he doesn't want her to switch to being a male either. And, you know, like, but she knows that he's attracted to her. She's just trying to stay away from him because it, you know, he, Tristan feels like a man in a woman's body. So he's just, you know, kind of creeped out, by his attention.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm trying to find it at one point. He catches up with her and, Tristan's just like, you know, you want to see this body without its clothing and you want to touch this body and I don't, I don't want to have anything to do with it. Pretty amusing.
Please don't change.
Please don't change.
Especially during intercourse.
Yeah, that would be bad timing. All of a sudden, the mouth you're kissing has a mustache above it.
Yeah. Whoa! I have one other book I want to mention. this is, since we all did DC books, I'm going to vector away and do an independent. This is Strange Days, number one. From Eclipse Comics, 1984, with writer Peter Milligan and art by Brendan McCarthy and Brett Ewins, Tony Wright. It's an anthology of kind of like sci-fi. It only lasted 3 issues in the 80s, and I only have issue 1. But I liked it well enough that I want to seek out issue 2. It's billed as the first truly new wave comic. And it has a I think the first story is called Shockwave, which I really didn't understand, but the concept behind it is really bizarre. It's like you have all these different races and stuff in the future floating around in different types of heads, like to do battle, like their spaceships are in heads. So they have like a JFK head. They have like a, I can't remember what the other heads were, but it's really bizarre. And looks like they're going to go to war. And that story was artistically interesting, but it was hard to follow. And but the next two stories I really liked. One of them was called Johnny Nemo, which is a futuristic PI in the vein of Judge Dredd, other than he's a private investigator. It was really cool. And the last one was Paradax, and that was about some dude that opened up a box that he found, and it had a costume in it, and that costume allows him to like phase through things and stuff. And I really enjoyed that. So I'm going to try to seek these out. I think I bought this book for $1, so I could probably get the other two really cheap. But I kind of want to follow it just to finish the two stories that I did like. Mm-hmm. And to see what the various spaceship heads end up doing. End up fighting each other or what.
How long did was that anthology around for a while?
Oh, just for 3 issues.
Okay.
It didn't succeed. It said it was like a a failed attempt, but it's very like Vertigo-ish. Like if you were to do like sci-fi Vertigo, it's very, very much in that. And like the, it feels kind of like at least the second story and the first story feel like a 2000 AD type story.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last one went into like a futuristic superhero type story, but it was pretty cool.
That's cool. Yeah. Eclipse did some really cool stuff back in the day.
Yeah.
Cool stuff.
This has an interesting write-up. This is from Slings and Arrows Comics Guide, which this was a fantastic guide if you could ever get your hands on it. But before computers became like, you know, and Wikipedia became so big, there was a book that actually cataloged every book that was ever published. And it gave you a little synopsis of every book. And like this one said, it was truly the first new wave comic, a collection of stories by Peter Milligan illustrated by Brendan McCarthy and Brett Owens, certainly looked radical compared to the rest of Eclipse's output. Apart from the surreal drug-fueled shockwave, for which McCarthy conjured up an amazing watery landscapes above which floating huge vessels in the shape of famous people's heads, the other strips were firmly rooted in the superhero tradition, but given enough spin to make them fun and cool. Unfortunately, Johnny Nemo, stylist Future PI, and Paradax, the Gauntlet Gouch teen superhero, didn't catch on. Although these characters survived the title's brief lifespan to appear in UK newsstand anthology Deadline, they were collected in a one shot. So they didn't succeed with them. But it was an interesting concept. I found more interesting is that I posted this about 3 weeks ago on my Facebook page, and I got a lot of comments. So there's people that knew what this was. And usually I post something that, and I don't get any feedback. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But this one drove a lot of discussion. So it was an interesting that this particular, a lot of people thought this was based on the movie Strange Days, which it wasn't.
Yeah, that's it's interesting when you discover something and it's, you know, it's kind of new to you, and then find out who that remembers it or something that they came across from back in the day or something.
Yeah,
that's always kind of neat. Interesting. It's interesting to hear. You know, it's probably pretty early in Peter Milligan's career too, right?
Yeah, I would think so. 1984. Yeah. Let's see. The first work that I ever read from him was Shade the Changeling from Vertigo.
Which that was later than that, I think. Would have been.
That is from, 1990. So, it's probably really early. That was a weird drug psychedelic comic. Lasted 70 issues, though. That's pretty... It's a long time.
Yeah, I didn't read that, but... Of course, he brought him briefly into Justice League Dark at the beginning of the New 52, that character.
Yeah, and he was in Suicide Squad. I mean, that character's been around since he had his own Steve Ditko series that lasted 8 issues in the 1970s, 1977.
Mm-hmm.
So he took a character from that early in the DC mythos and made it a Vertigo character, kind of like they did with Swamp Thing and Animal Man.
Yeah.
Both created in the 70s or 60s and made Vertigo titles.
Right, yeah, kind of. That was definitely a period of time where they were bringing over British creators and getting them to using up old properties that kind of were dead and reinvigorating them with new ideas and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I don't see any. Did you end up getting any questions on?
Oh, yeah, we got one question.
Okay.
God, trying to find it's going to suck. That's what happens when. I wish you could bookmark stuff in Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be awesome feature where you go to your wall and you say, I want to bookmark this, and then you'd be able to find it.
Was that so they ended up on your, on your page? Okay, cause I don't see any on the Geek Brunch page.
I took your questions and I put it on my page.
Yeah, I saw that.
I have a lot more people that follow me than follow our page. Oh, shit. Well, I remember the question. It was from Amy, who's the co-host of Rookie and the Geek with Daryl. And she just said, what are some of your favorite retro horror movies? Which is kind of a good theme, being that it's almost Halloween.
Yeah, timely. I showed Kara a horror movie last night, which is not going to qualify for this question, but... it just made me think of it. We watched, I showed her The Descent, which I watched the first time a couple years ago. It's the one with the all-female cast to go caving.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, it's a pretty good movie.
I actually thought the first part of the movie, before they introduced the character, the little troll beings or whatever they were,
mm-hmm.
I thought was more terrifying because of the claustrophobia type aspect of caving.
Oh my god! I mean, if you're clinically claustrophobic, like stay away from that movie. Oh my god!
Because I went caving and I wasn't as fat as I was that I am now, and it was hard because there were areas where, you know, we went. Me and Barb had flashlights and stuff, and there was one area that was like really narrow, and I barely fit.
Yeah.
And it was like, I could get stuck here.
Yeah, both times I watched that movie, I went caving once, and it was probably like 98, around there. And this was a cave that was well mapped out. We had a guy that knew where they were going. So, I mean, it's not like in the movie where they're by themselves and it turns out they're in a cave that's not really been explored recently. And, oh my God, like both times I watched that movie, I'm like, I can't believe I ever did this before because I don't think I would ever do it again. I'm not super claustrophobic, but man, like some of the scenes in that movie where they're just crawling through these small areas and it's just like, oh man, the idea of getting stuck. One of the thing that's probably most frightening is just the idea of like later on when they're separated from each other and just by being by yourself with a limited light source underground, not knowing if you can find your way out.
Mm-hmm.
Damn. But, No, that came out like 2005, so I wouldn't qualify that, but we try to watch a scary movie because Halloween's coming up.
Yeah, I want to watch some more scary movies. AMC has a lot of them going on now. I just haven't had time. I guess as a kid, I had a fondness for like this TV program that was like horror theater that used to show like Universal Horror Monsters. Mm-hmm. I used to like to watch like Dracula. Dracula I'd have the hardest time with because he'd scare the shit out of me. I mean, of all the horror monsters, Bela Lugosi is scary, man. I swear his eyes are like all the other Draculas that came after him, like,
mm-hmm.
you know, Christopher Lee and stuff like that. I wasn't scared of, man. They didn't terrify me. And then you got the curly-haired Dracula, and they started to look more, like, handsome and stuff, and they didn't terrify me. But Bela Lugosi, I mean, even if you see pictures of him not as a vampire, he's pretty scary-looking. I mean, if you watch the Ed Wood movie where they have the one actor play Bela Lugosi, he's terrifying. But Dracula, I would say, is like one of the oldest pictures. Nosferatu, if you even want to go to the 20s, is pretty terrifying. Mm-hmm. As far as the look of a vampire, he's probably the most scary, and they kind of used his look in Salem's Lot, which was another movie that I thought was really, really frightening when I saw that movie with David Soul in the 70s. I thought it was very creepy, especially the scene where the kid's friend is like floating outside the window. That always scared me. You all right?
I guess Luna agrees with you.
She just said, "Roof."
Yeah, I don't know what brought that on. She came into the room and
I think she's like, "Daddy, I need to go for a walk."
That's mom's job right now. She does the walk during the podcast. She came into the room and jumped up on the futon next to me.
Oh, nice.
She likes that futon. Like, I have a couple of videos of her jumping up on there and like rolling around and rubbing her head against the back of it. But I looked at her and I stared at her in the eyes and then she barked at me. Like, "Hey, what are you doing?"
Yeah, Harley does that when she wants my attention.
Yeah, it's about that. It's about time for her.
Yeah.
Her walk, but I mean, Halloween, the original, I always go back to. I just think it's, even as a film, like a really cool, really well done movie. I don't know how scary it is at this point, but I mean, it inspired and kicked off a lot of slasher movies that maybe aren't as like high quality as a film per se, but the original Halloween, I think, really was a really good movie. Dawn of the Dead is one of my favorites of those, like the original. You gotta give it some leeway for the special effects. I mean, for the time, they're very, very good. It came out in like late 70s. Those are like Tom Savini.
Yeah, he's actually in that movie too as a motorcycle dude.
Yeah. So that's.
It's amazing that stuff, while it did have cult following, isn't as big mm-hmm. as Walking Dead, because the formula for Walking Dead is all there in those movies. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, totally. Yeah.
It's the same formula. There's nothing different about it, but yet Walking Dead has seemed to capture a mass audience where those movies are more like, yeah, horror films, horror people pretty much know about them, but I don't think it's at the Walking Dead craze.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you had, obviously, like that, like the two people that originally involved in The Living Dead, I mean, you had, obviously, people know the George Romero films, you know, which Dawn of the Dead was the next one. I also like Day of the Dead a lot, too. That's the next one after that, which is pretty different.
That one I liked a lot, but I didn't care for the situation. You know how they were in the military facility?
Yeah, it's like an underground bunker.
Yeah, an underground bunker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not thought of as highly, it seems like, as Dawn of the Dead, but I like it a lot.
Dawn of the Dead is my favorite of mm-hmm. of all the Romero movies, and I've seen all of them.
Yeah,
Survival of the Dead, and even the ones that have came out direct to DVD. But some of them are really good. Even they're even lower budget than than the ones we had back then.
The last one I saw was Land of the Dead.
Huh. No, there's stuff after that. Diary of the Dead. Mm-hmm. And there's Survival of the Dead.
Yeah.
And one of them, I think it's Survival of the Dead, is almost like a Hatfield versus McCoy type scenario where they get to an island and it's two families that hate each other that have to deal with the zombies as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that made for an interesting movie. But yeah, those are good movies. Dawn of the Dead, though, man, I loved it.
Yeah, it's my favorite too.
Even the remake, I love. I find the remake even more terrifying because of they're fast.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't live if they're fast. I mean, at least with when they're slow, you have a chance.
Right. Yeah, you don't have any chance in that scenario.
But when you have a jaw just snapping at you, like at an incredible speed, it's. And uncontrollably, you know what I mean, random, it's hard mm-hmm. to defend that.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll accept I don't like the remake as much as the original, but I'm not somebody that has to have, like, a specific type of rule, you know, to a zombie film. Like, I'll accept fast zombies as long as it's done, as long as it's an interesting movie, you know, or whatever it is. I mean... Or like you have like the 28 days later, where it's more of like a medical condition or whatever that causes it. And I think those are fast zombies too, right?
Yeah. Which was the kind of the opening of Walking Dead, is like him waking up in a hospital bed and then there's zombies everywhere.
Yeah, they kind of start pretty.
They kind of took that from that movie, I think. At least when I read The Walking Dead the first time, I was like, "Wow, that's like 28 days later."
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought too, because I had seen the film prior to reading Walking Dead, and I thought, "Man, that's kind of the same beginning." And they go very different places, but they sort of start out the same.
The Exorcist scares the hell out of me. And
that's an
old film, but anytime you involve the devil in some manner, it always scared me.
I only just saw it a couple of years ago for the first time, and
Linda Blair is frightening.
It stands up, and I won't straight up spoil it, because I think it's pretty shocking if you haven't seen it, but the scene with the crucifix, involving the crucifix in her.
Yeah.
I think it's only in the unrated version, but which is pretty much the main version that you find. But it's surprising that you could still be shocked by a movie that's from the 70s, you know? The other kind of series that came out of the original Night of the Living Dead was The Return of the Living Dead, which came out in the 80s, and it's more of a comedy. I don't know if you've ever seen them.
Yeah, I've seen all of them, and the special effects were freaking awesome. Even though it was humorous at times, the effects were so much better. Don't you agree?
Yeah, I mean, this one's kind of more of like chemical, like there's these chemical cylinders, and they get... They get released and it causes the dead to rise, but there's
but there were dead in those cylinders. Do you know what I mean? They had captured zombies at some point, and I think it was because of chemical warfare they made these things. And the gas gets released, or they lose canisters and all hell breaks loose.
Yeah, and it starts to rain, so that spreads the chemicals and stuff, and it's pretty effective at being a comedy, but also still a horror movie. And then you have the plus of Linnea Quigley, the Scream Queen. She's in it with like a group of these like punk rockers that are hanging out in the graveyard, just be weird.
Yeah, and there's a crematorium or a funeral home right next to it.
Yeah, so she, before the dead start rising out of the graveyard, she decides to like strip completely naked and dance on top of a gravestone.
That was awesome.
And then the dead start to rise, and they freak out, start running, so she's like she's naked for like half the film.
Even as the zombie, even when she's bit, she's naked.
Yeah. So you got that going for you there. Another one that's kind of a comedy is that came out around the same time as Night of the Creeps. This movie, it's like kind of a tribute to like 50s sci-fi horror films, and it's about these alien slugs that it's sort of a zombie movie and sort of not. I mean, these alien slugs get inside people and infect them and turn them into like the people start acting kind of like zombies, and it has Tom Atkins, who is a great like B movie actor from the time as a former cop, and he's really camps it up in the movie. He's really funny in there. If you've seen Halloween 3, the one that really doesn't have anything to do with Jason Myers,
that's right. That's the masks, the Halloween masks.
Yeah. He's the main dude in that movie. Like people know him from that. That's a fun one. That's not too scary.
Yeah.
More like a fun, it's like real campy.
The first Friday the 13th movie scared the hell out of me. And that I saw on, I remember I was on my parents' bed watching it on some kind of cable, early cable, and the fact that it was his mom initially, and then I really fell for the scene where she's saved on the boat, you know, like she's floating on the boat and then Jason jumps out of the river. Mm-hmm. I screamed bloody murder. I scared the whole household. It's like, ah!
Yeah, that's kind of a surprise stinger at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a little trivia really there, is that Jason's not really the killer until the second film.
Yeah. And then
he doesn't really have the hockey mask until the third one, right?
Yeah. The other thing that scared me is the entity. That's probably not a well-known horror film, but it's based on a true story, and that's what scared the shit out of me, is that I watched the whole film, and it was pretty much disturbing. It's about this lady that gets attacked by this creature or ghost that nobody can see, and nobody believes her. And she's sexually assaulted, too. She ends up with bruises everywhere and stuff, and doctors can't explain it and whatever. And she eventually gets camera crews over there, and they witness it. So she has people that believe her. But at the end of the film, they mentioned the woman's name. And they said, this woman's still being attacked today, but not as frequently. And I'm like, holy shit! It terrified me. I'm like, what? I was terrified.
Yeah, I was pretty I really didn't really watch horror movies until in my 30s. I don't know why. I couldn't separate, prior to that, I just couldn't separate reality and fiction well enough to separate from myself from it. Like nowadays I can watch, I've seen some pretty gory stuff, but as long as I know it's fake, like I have no interest in seeing like Faces of Death or anything like that where it's actually real violence. But as long as I know, even if it looks super real, as long as I know it's fake, I can watch it. But so a lot of these are fresh in my mind because all of a sudden I was like, oh, I can watch horror movies now, and I went on a tear and like watched a ton of them. But what's it called? But I like, you know, in the 80s were pretty good for these movies that had an effective balance of comedy and horror, you know, and I like a lot of those. And and what's Fright Night?
Oh, that was Isn't that one of your favorites? That's one of my favorite. That one, people don't think of it as horror, but it terrifies the hell out of me. Like a vampire moving next door and then threatening you. Like he gave Charlie a chance. Like he says, you forget about me and I'll let you live. Like, don't know. He knows that there's girls being killed across, you know, just right next door. Nobody believes him. And he decides to put a pencil through his hand and causes a war between the two of them. And I found that terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, if you see it as a doll, it's not the scariest movie, but it's a good, well-made movie.
Yeah, but my fear of vampires plays a little bit of a part into that. Because Dandridge is pretty creepy. At least I think he is.
Mm-hmm. I didn't see the remake, but apparently it's actually not that bad.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty good. It's not as good as the original, but I guess if you hold a movie in such high regard, it's hard to make that mental transition.
Yeah. You said the original Friday the 13th, and I think the original Nightmare on Elm Street is pretty good, and that one, and then the third one, Dream Warriors. Mm-hmm. I would say the two that really, if you're only going to see a couple of those, which I've seen all of the Elm Street movie except for the hell is that?
What?
Oh, maybe it's only I'm hearing it. I'm hearing like a Skype advertisement from Mucinex in the background. Hopefully that's not didn't come across on the
No, I can't hear anything.
Right, that's good. What the crap is going on? Stupid Skype. Sorry about that. But
actually, yeah, anyway. I couldn't hear it. So
that's good.
Nobody heard it.
so everyone's just listening, thinking, what the fuck is...
What is this Mucinex stuff?
He's talking about horror movies, and now he's going crazy. But yeah, I didn't see the remake of Elm Street, but I've seen all the other ones, and a lot of them are kind of crappy. But I stand by the first one and the third one. The third one was actually done by Frank Darabont, and it's a good one. The second one, if you want to see a weird freaking movie, though, the second Elm Street movie is really, really weird.
I don't remember it.
It's
not the girl with white hair.
No, it's the second one is like it's probably the most like homoerotic movie that I've ever seen that's not explicitly about like gay people.
Oh wow.
Yeah, it's really strange. There's just this like strange homoerotic subtext to the entire thing.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, like people have, like they've never officially said that was intentional, but people that involved in the making of the film have pretty much said as much. And, but it's not a really good movie. It's actually like unlike any other films. Like the main protagonist is a guy, as sort of suggested by what I've already said. And there's just some really weird scenes. Like this main character, he's like walking the streets at night, and he walks into this like gay leather bar where he runs into his high school gym coach, and as like punishment for finding him there, his coach takes him like over to the school, and he makes him run laps and then hit the showers. And he comes to the showers, and like Freddy ends up appearing. But before that, like his coach, like you get this like creepy vibe, and like all of a sudden, like the sports equipment comes alive and starts like the jump ropes bind him by the wrists, and he drags him back into the shower, and like the shower heads come on, and like it's all like super hot and scalding him, and the like soccer balls and stuff like that are flying at and hit them and stuff, and like he wanders after he like escapes, but he wanders around the neighborhood naked, and like comes home, and his dad thinks he's on drugs, and it's really, really weird.
So does the second one have any of the characters from the first one? Or is that no. The third one? They bring back with the girl with the gray hair or the gray streak.
Right, Heather Langenkamp. Yeah, it's almost like when they made the third one, it was almost like they tried to pretend that the second one didn't exist. And a lot of times when you see like retrospectives of the series, they don't really talk about the second one very much.
Wow. That's so interesting.
Yeah, I mean, not that the concept is objectionable of like having a horror movie that stars a guy that's gay or anything like that. It's just like, but if you watch it, the way that it's done is just like super bizarre and strange.
I did watch them all back in the day. I just don't remember a lot. I remember the first one, and I guess I remember the third one because the main character returned.
Right.
And then I don't remember anything after that.
Yeah, you're not missing too much. I mean, the third one is really, really good. There's some parts of, I guess it's probably the fourth and the fifth one that are kind of sequel to each other that are good, but there's parts of it, like, there's like a potential for some like really good movies there, but that's not entirely realized.
Yeah.
But yeah, Dream Master and Dream Child. They're kind of like five is kind of a sequel to four.
Mm-hmm. I thought Poltergeist was pretty scary when I saw that. Like, even though it was like a PG-13 movie,
mm-hmm.
I thought it was pretty frightening. The Shining was another one that the concept of you somebody being alone in a huge hotel for the winter just scares me. That concept alone scares me, and the fact that even if it's not haunted, that you're alone in such a big place. It's terrifying.
Yeah, I think I saw like part of that on TV when I was a kid, and it pretty freaked me out. But I mean, it didn't take much when I was a kid to be afraid. So yeah, I don't know. That's some of them. I like horror movies.
Yeah. And then Gail Willis said, back in the day, guilty pleasure comic book. I don't think I had any guilty pleasures. I was never embarrassed reading any of my comics.
Yeah, would you interpret that as...
Oh, I got one.
What's that?
In high school, I discovered porn comics.
Uh-huh.
And I started buying a comic called Ramba, and it was nasty.
Was that like a female Rambo or something? Or?
Except she'd fuck everybody to death.
Oh.
That was a guilty pleasure. Like, I don't know if I'd want anybody to like find out I was reading Ramba, but now everybody knows. So
yeah, you didn't want anybody to know at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if I had guilty pleasures at the time. Like, there are some things that I liked back then that now I would be, you know, feel a little guilty about, but I don't know if I had any at the time. I mean, now I look back and some of the, like Image swimsuit issues and stuff like that. I don't know that I would, like... I would necessarily take that up to the counter at the comic shop nowadays.
Yeah.
But certain before Image started, you know, you had Eric Larson drawing Mary Jane and Amazing Spider-Man, and Jim Lee on X-Men drawing like Rogue and Psylocke. And maybe it was a guilty pleasure in terms of how some of those panels affected me. But yeah, I didn't really have any guilty pleasures at the time, though, because, I mean, I was into comic books in the first place, so.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I really do. I don't know either.
Those are the only questions we had.
Yeah,
I gotta talk about the whole horror movies for like a whole episode.
Well, yeah, that we got some good mileage out of that.
Anyways, just you talk about like comedies that were kind of horror. When I was a kid and I saw Young Frankenstein, Marty Feldman, I think his name was Marty Feldman, the guy who played Igor with the big eyes, scared the shit out of me, and like my best friend knew that. So he would, like, get pictures of him, or he'd like, pretend. He'd, like, ooh, he's coming after you. Igor's coming after you. And I'd get all frightened and terrified. But then, as I got older, Young Frankenstein became one of the best comedies I've ever seen.
Oh, yeah. Actually, a couple years ago, I saw that on stage, like, a musical version of it. It was actually pretty – I'm not, like, a big musical person, but – my parents go regularly every year, and they got me a ticket to join them on that one because I thought, oh, that'll be pretty cool. Oh, no, actually what it was is my mom couldn't go because she had foot surgery, and so I took her ticket. And it worked out good because, yeah, that was fun. They did a good job of it. But, yeah, that's a good example. That's definitely one that leans towards the comedy. I like the Reanimator. Have you seen that?
No, never.
From the '80s. That's a really campy, gory, it's technically based off of a short story by, H.P. Lovecraft, but they really just take it and run with it. So it takes place at like, medical school at Arkham. You know, it's all about this scientist to the reanimator, who he is experimenting with, reanimating lifeless bodies, and he gets kicked out of the profession for experimenting, doing crazy experiments and everything like that. And obviously he's successful, so there's like this, he at one point reanimates this corpse with whose head's been cut off, so it walks around holding its head in its hands. But it's just like it's really campy and really super gory in like a totally fake kind of way,
I've always wanted to see it because he's kind of prominent in like comic books too. Like they've had Reanimator team up with Army of Darkness and mm-hmm. other stuff like that. So
yeah, totally. Yeah,
it's like a cult classic when they do that, and it's one of those cult classics that I've never watched.
Yeah, you would like it, I think. I think it's actually, I want to say it's on Netflix streaming, so you could subject Keith to it. yeah, it is. This campy send-up follows a medical student who develops a serum that miraculously revives the dead. With his roommate and his girlfriend, he reanimates the corpse, but he doesn't factor in certain complications.
I wish I would have picked that, then. I picked The Possession, which is one is more like, I guess, in the Exorcist-type vein.
Okay.
And then Daryl picked Blackenstein. So that's that'll be an interesting 70s pick.
I've seen Blackula, but I haven't seen Blackenstein.
Yeah, I haven't seen Blackenstein.
The 70s and the 80s were great for movies, man. I miss when you could be like, you didn't have to be super attractive to be in movies.
Yeah.
The 70s was great for that, It's become less and less common. But, there's a lot of good stuff out there, for sure.
So you want to jump into 3 more issues of Mr. Miracle?
Sounds good.
All right. So we have Mr. Miracle number 15. By Jack Kirby and Mike Royer. And this one focuses on the first appearance of Shiloh Norman, who in the 80s, I want to say the 80s or maybe it was the 90s, he actually became Mr. Miracle at one point. So this mm-hmm. these 3 issues kind of show you his progression as he becomes part of the entourage, I guess you could say, of Mr. Miracle and Company.
Yeah, like his origin story.
Yeah, it's a weird story because a detective... Have we seen this detective before?
I don't believe so.
Detective Driver, I don't believe we've seen him. He's a detective, and he brings over Shiloh Norman, I guess, to witness one of the escapes of Mr. Miracle, and also bring him... so he can protect him because somebody's going to kill him because they killed his brother and he knows who killed his brother and he's in like the witness protection program. And they set up this very unusual contraption where he's in a canister. They tie his arms together. He gets in the canister, close the canister, and Big Barter has like these huge pliers. And the pliers are supposed to snap the canister in half. And
I turned the page to this, blast page to this, and I had to start cracking up. This is one of the best traps, I have to say, just because of the size. I don't know where they got those pliers, but if there was like a hardware store for the Jolly Green Giant, like that's where they would sell those, because those things are just mammoth. It's hilarious.
Yeah, it's probably one of my favorite traps as well.
Yeah.
And she snaps it, and Bart is not surprised he escaped, but he shows up behind Shiloh and Detective Driver, and he tells him the situation, and he actually explains to how he survived it. But then randomly, it's like, here, this is the part I don't understand about Mr. Miracle, and I have problems with some of these storylines, is it seems like villains just show up at his house, and in this type, it's somebody just launching a grenade into the room to blow him up, and you kind of see Shiloh's bravery here, because he just like he jumps in the air to grab the grenade and throw it back out before Mr. Miracle, but he's like, "You didn't have to do that. It won't explode. I disabled it."
Well, actually, the reason that this dude shows up and throws they're actually after Shiloh.
Yeah, they're after Shiloh, but that would have to witness. That would have to mean that they knew he was there. I don't know.
Yeah.
And in the next issue, you have all of a sudden you have these like microscopic bugs, but they explain that later.
Yeah.
But it's kind of unusual.
Kirby wasn't beyond using some plot conveniences in his writing, that's for sure. But that was also fairly a lot more common at the time, you know.
Yeah.
He was definitely not the only one in the 70s doing that.
And in the 70s, the one thing I wanted to mention is I watched that Superheroes The Never Ending Battle PBS special. Oh, so damn awesome. They had like so many photos and stuff, like clips of old stuff that happened in the 50s and 60s that were just phenomenal.
So you would say it's worth watching even if you're familiar with a lot of the history?
Oh yeah. Well, I did learn a couple things. I learned that I never realized that Clark Kent tried to join the army. And when he went to join the army, he read the eye chart that was like three buildings down or whatever, and he failed the eye test. So they didn't let him join the army. And then Lois gave him all kinds of shit, like, "You big loser, you're not going to even defend your country." And I thought that was interesting. They had a lot of Steranko in there, and he's a fascinating dude in itself. But he said how he first got into Marvel Comics, and he went to the office, and I guess Stan Lee liked his portfolio. He's like, he pretty much offered him every Marvel book. He said, "You pick one that's on the stands right there." And I guess Steranko went with the one that was the least popular. He went with S.H.I.E.L.D., you know, Tales of Suspense or whatever it was in, because I think he thought, as a newcomer, he can't do no wrong with something that's selling so low. So, yeah, there were some interesting things. I didn't know that the church attacked the Wonder Woman comics. That kind of surprised me. And I'm a huge Wonder Woman fan. So, yeah, I did learn some stuff. There's some good and visually, and I still have another 40 minutes or so to watch, but it's pretty fantastic.
Cool. Nice. Is it just one episode?
It's like a three-hour episode, yeah.
Cool. Nice.
So back to our regularly scheduled program.
Yeah. I like that, so while this is going on, the guy who threw the bomb, or the grenade into the house, gets caught by Barda, who she goes after them, and catches up to him, and she comes back carrying him in one hand.
She is awesome.
then we get to find out a little bit about who's behind all this. It's a guy named Mr. Fez. Who sort of an appropriate name, because he's a dude and he wears a fez. So I don't know which came first, the name or the hat, but either way it works. And they're building this big ass gun that they're gonna, I guess it's like a disintegrator or something. Or, I guess it's not here that they name it, but later on they introduce
the guy that paralyzes people so they can go rob them.
Right, yeah. It's, later on, they introduce Jammer, the guy that is responsible for building this weaponry for his outfit. But so you know, they're supposed to. So Mr. Miracle and gang, they're supposed to be keeping an eye on Shiloh, and they put him. You know, he's a kid. They put him to bed, he hasn't been really eating much, and he's being a little rude to them as he's being put to bed, and so they close the door and leave. But Mr. Miracle knows that something is up, so they stand outside and are quiet for a moment, and then open the door. And sure enough, Shiloh was wearing his clothes underneath the covers and was planning on escaping as soon as they left, and that's why he was acting that way, because he wants to, you know, go after. The reason that you know, Shiloh's caught up in this is that his brother was murdered, so he wants to go after the murderer himself. He's not content to just let the police take care of it. So, you know, Mr. Miracle suits up. Barda, for some reason, I mean, she wears like a white top and some leggings. I guess she, you know, night on the town.
She looks good no matter what she wears.
It doesn't matter, so. But yeah, they catch up with Shiloh in time to see him enter this warehouse, where he comes across a bunch of more henchmen that look like the one that threw the grenade in. And actually, it turns out, you know, like Shiloh, he's capable of holding his own. I mean, he's an expert in judo, and
he's judo master.
Judo master, yeah. And he has a reputation. Like, apparently his big brother used to brag about him. So these hoods know. One says, the little dude's a black belt judo expert. His brother used to brag about it. And yeah, he takes a lot of them out. When Barda and Mr. Miracle show up to help out, but just at that time, Mr. Fez shows up with his dude Jammer, who has a weapon that takes out the two heroes.
It jams their brainwaves, yeah. So it like shuts them down.
Yeah, they pretty much drop. But they leave Shiloh awake because they want to. They strap him to the big gun that they have aimed out at the city, because it'll go through him, affect him, and still that won't dampen the effect on the rest of the city.
I love how Barda comes into the room then when they reawaken and Shiloh's strapped to the gun, and she just pulls the gun apart. She just lifts it apart, destroys it. And then Mr. Fez pulls a regular gun on Mr. Miracle, and he blasts it with his glove. He shoots a blast and destroys the gun, and then Detective Driver comes in and arrests everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of take him on as a ward, so he's kind of like the sidekick to Mr. Miracle and Big Barda.
Yeah, and I would say that's my favorite thing about this issue is Shiloh Norman, definitely right from the beginning, has charisma, you know, as a character. He's an interest, like, I'm interested in. I like him joining their group, and I like the addition of, you know, like, someone. And the whole idea, I mean, I'm a sucker for legacy characters, so the whole idea of, you know, Scott Free picked up the Mr. Miracle, identity himself from someone else, and the idea of him training protege is really cool, and you know, it makes sense that as someone that grew up, like, on Apocalypse with Granny Goodness and stuff, like, he would be sympathetic to someone who, you know, doesn't have a lot of family around him and lost what family he has. So the plot itself of the issue is all right, but I like the introduction of Shiloh.
Mm-hmm. And that leads us into issue number 16, which is also features Shiloh Norman, and he's training Shiloh to get out of. He's basically getting trained by two people, One is to Mr. Miracle so he can learn to do super escapes and learn the technologies to do the escapes. And the other is by Big Barda to learn how to fight special powers demonstrations and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And this is a weird story because during training he's seeing like images of these insect creatures and nobody else is seeing them. And he's like, Barda, look, there they are. And then every time they look, they think he's like losing his mind or he doesn't want to train or he's making up excuses. But the story takes off where the insect creature actually captures Oberon and Big Barda. And then Mr. Miracle believes what's going on and he tells Ted Brown and they find out that Mr. Miracle's glove actually finds out that there's tiny like dots and that they're not really escaping. They're miniaturizing the sizes that they can't detect.
Mm-hmm.
And then coming back out. And Shiloh Norman seems to be the type of guy to jump into a fight and not think. Do you know what I mean? He seems to just... So as the monster bug comes in, he's the first in to go fight him.
Yeah. Yeah, and I thought it was interesting how, you know, in these issues, how he gets introduced and he's featured pretty prominently, you know.
Yeah.
So it's cool that even though Kirby didn't have a hand in it later, that they eventually, you know, the scot-free Mr. Miracle continued to be featured for a while in Justice League and stuff like that. But it's cool that they sort of honored the amount of attention that he gets here by making him the Mr. Miracle for real later on. But yeah, as you said, I mean, he rushes in and ends up kind of on his own, using the technology that he's just still getting used to, and he comes across comes across this guy who is like a Mr. Professor Egg, who has a big bald egg-shaped head, and he is. He's basically creating these hybrid creatures that are a combination of an insect and a human. And the way that he traps Shiloh to use him is that they're down in these caverns and shrunk down while he returns Shiloh to normal size, which to the extent that he gets, you know, is just big enough to be stuck and unable to move in the caverns that they're in. So then they set up a machine with this larva attached to it with the intention of combining Shiloh's molecules with it to create a new creature, which they do and turns out pretty freaking looking. It does kind of look like a Shiloh combined with the larva.
Yeah, I do like the designs of these creatures.
Mm-hmm.
I like the one with the missiles on his back.
Yeah.
Like, he's like a roly-poly or something.
Yeah, and his mask reminds me of that dude from Space Coast, Brack or whatever his name is.
Oh, yeah,
that,
yeah,
that really,
yeah.
That really funny dude.
Mm-hmm.
His mask looks kind of the same. But it ends kind of funny because, you know, just after this creature is introduced, Shiloh starts screaming in terror, and then all of a sudden he opens his eyes to find himself laying in a bunch of boxes back in...
Yes. That's really weird because it's like everything he experienced was just an illusion to him. Like he didn't experience him, and then they introduce Professor EXE, and he's the master of illusion, so you think he might have pulled a fast one on him, I guess.
Yeah, it ends ambiguously. You don't really know what happens because the Professor EXE, or I guess, you know, you could say that Professor X, who's also a bald dude, so I don't know if that was a little little joke there, but he's Professor Egg, and he looks the exact same as that dude, so it's like it's kind of like up in the air, like, did that really happen, or was it an illusion, or is this Professor X like Professor Egg, and Shiloh's the only one that really knows what's going on, or what? It kind of ends ambiguously and abruptly.
Yeah, like nothing ever happened. It was a bad dream. And then this third story is number 17, which is my favorite. I like the haunted house ones. I mean, we had the Miss Big Eyes or whatever in the previous.
Yeah.
And this one's kind of like, these guys are like doing a travel show, and they're the only thing I didn't like about this issue is we didn't have any Oberon. Like, he's not part of the pack, or he stayed behind with the van, or I don't know what happened.
Right.
But it's just the three of them that show up at this hotel. They're exhausted. They want to get some sleep. And this creepy innkeeper just allows them in, and he looks evil, and Shiloh gives him shit up front, and Mr. Miracle and Bart are like, come on, quit acting like a fool. But he's like, this dude, he looks like something out of an old movie villain.
Yeah. And he has his own costume, though.
Yeah.
Shiloh does. He's got his own like version of Mr. Miracle costume. He's part of the act now. It's pretty cool.
And at this point, I don't know if Mr. Miracle and Big Bart are seeing each other romantically, but there's something going on, but they still have separate rooms. Mm-hmm. So she gets her room, and as soon as she lays down, gas is emitted, and she's electrocuted on top of her bed, and then the bed flips over, and it's like she wasn't even there. And and then the same sort of thing happens when Mr. Miracle goes to his bed. The bed flips over, and he goes away, but Shiloh is too fast and avoids the freeze gas, and then starts using his judo as this guy comes after him with a huge mallet.
Yeah, the owner of the place. Yeah, he
Thor.
Yeah, he's got like he pulled the sledgehammer out of the supply closet or something like that. But yeah, Shadow's definitely too much for this guy, who was kind of in and over his head, and he knocks him out and takes off. And there's a few other traps that he almost gets caught in. His hands get stuck to the wall in a doorway that's actually a hidden guillotine. You know, thanks to his training, Shiloh's able to escape that. But unfortunately, the Peppy, the guy that runs this place, has someone else working for him, who comes up behind Shiloh and knocks him out, and they throw him into Inferno Room. You know, so we find out that this whole like situation is this hotel. It's basically a front for these guys. They let criminals stay there and pretend that it's a safe haven for them, but then they trap them and turn them in for the reward money. They don't turn them into cops, but they turn them into like this group, the Syndicate, who's kind of like so they're, you know, if people are on the run from like the mob or something like that, then these guys double cross them.
Yeah, they were after the tricky trio, who coincidentally look exactly like.
Right. So that's,
I mean,
yeah.
They could fit in as these three characters. So
right. They're pretty much the doubles, and that's the other thing that's going on here, is that they think that that Barta, Miracle, and Shiloh are this are actually these criminals that they are duplicates for, but they're obviously not. So when the criminals actually show up, the Peppy and his buddy there are like, oh shit, because Dove the Dinosaur, Mad Merkin, and Little Bullets show up. And Della kind of looks just like Barta, except for she's got, you know, a scarf around her neck, and her hair is sort of feathered. She looks more of like a Bonnie of Bonnie and the Clyde kind of woman. Little Bullets looks just like Shiloh, except for he's got, you know, like a suit on and a little gun. And then Mad Merkin, basically, like, is just a dude with his arm in a sling, and but his whole head is wrapped up.
Kind of like the Unknown Soldier.
Yeah, exactly. With sunglasses over it, so it's like you could mistake him for Mr. Miracle when Mr. Miracle has his mask on, because their faces are both covered.
And then it just turns into a shootout between the three. It's like three versus three.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because Shiloh escapes the Inferno Room and rescues Miracle and Barda.
Yeah. And Barda fights her counterpart and beats her up with a filing cabinet. Shiloh's getting shot at with a machine gun, but it manages to take out that guy. And Mr. Miracle takes out the unknown soldier. And then the cops show up. And the cops, when they walk in the room, that one fat cop, just the way he's portrayed, the way he's like walking, it looks kind of funny. It kind of walks like Daryl. It's like walking like Daryl Taylor.
Oh, yeah, they're like... They're almost like thrusting their hips out.
Yeah.
As they're walking.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. But yeah. Yeah, and Pippi or whatever his name was and his buddy, they try to escape while the melee's going on, but they get caught. So the cop, as he says, gosh almighty, it's a festival of felons. So they're excited because they nabbed five people all at once. But, you know, and they're actually interested in Miracle and in company, but they escape while they're attending to the real criminals. So we have one issue of Kirby done, Mr. Miracle left. And we have issue 6 of New Gods, which is from... where they, issues 1 through 5 were a reprint of the original New Gods series, and issue 6 was new material that continues the story. And then we have the Hunger Gods graphic novel. So
where did issue 6 get put out? I mean, there were all reprints, and issue 6 was brand new?
Yeah, if you, after, there's a little page that kind of explains it after Mr. Miracle 18. So in 1984, a new limited reprint series appeared containing all 11 issues of the New Gods, plus an all-new story, Even Gods Must Die. Even Gods Must Die bridged Kirby's previous Fourth World stories with the epic finale to his cosmic saga, Hunger Dogs, an original graphic novel published in 1985. So I thought, you know, maybe for the next time we can do... Mr. Miracle 18 and Even Gods Must Die.
Yeah.
And then the following episode we can finish up
the Hunger Dogs.
The Hunger Gods. Dogs. I'm gonna say gods.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Hunger Dogs, and then we will have completed the entire Fourth World saga.
Yep.
The only thing after that in this book is in volume 4 is which is kinda cool. They have the usual afterward, all the volumes have, but they also put all of the Fourth World Saga related pages from Who's Who, which Kirby drew. Those entries are in the back of this book also, which is a nice inclusion.
Yeah, it's a beautiful book. I don't know how they're going to wrap up Mr. Miracle, but we'll find out.
Yep, we'll find out next time. And at least as far as Kirby's concerned. Now, I found it interesting that, we can talk more about this next time, but Mr. Miracle did continue, but not right away. There was like a gap, and then they did decide to keep, they picked up with issue 19, but it wasn't really like right away.
It wasn't Jack Kirby either.
It wasn't Jack Kirby, but yeah, they didn't continue it immediately, but then
they did the same thing with New Gods.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Forever People eventually had a mini-series. But Mr. Miracle, I mean, would eventually have another solo series that ran for quite a while. I think his popularity kind of became popular again because he was part of the Wahaha Justice League. But, it's interesting to see I've been just kind of out of curiosity starting to, you know, just kind of dig around and look at how some of these characters were picked up and used by DC later on. Obviously, Darkseid has been used numerous times, and a lot of them have been making appearances in the New 52.
Yeah, Wonder Woman.
Wonder Woman and World's Finest.
It's a great title, Wonder Woman. I love that one.
You know, do you find the characterization of Oberon, Orion, do you find the characterization of Orion to be, like, the same character in Wonder Woman? Because he seems
brash. Well, he does seem brash still. And he seems arrogant, and he's still the same. Anger? You know, like he's always had an anger.
Yeah,
so but yeah, he is a little bit different, but he's got the main, at least the main things that I think make Orion Orion.
Yeah, I guess the thing that's different is he's just like a little bit more playful at times.
Yeah. Like slapping her ass and shit like that.
Yeah, like he flirts and messes with Wonder Woman.
He's almost like a combination of like Light Ray and Orion, because he's got like some lightheartedness to him that Light Ray always portrayed. And I don't know. He's a little different, but I think he's still got the same arrogance and attitude.
Yeah, it's definitely not like way off right there. And Zsasz has been the World's Finest, right? And Mr. Miracle and Bart have been in Earth 2 a little bit, right?
Yeah, Earth 2, and then Highfather has been in Wonder Woman as well. They've actually introduced New Genesis too.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I have to I've said that I've stopped getting single issue DC stuff, but there's some titles, especially the ones that are kind of like their own story, like Wonder Woman, I'd like to collect and trade, especially in the cases where I really enjoy the art, which I do enjoy the art in that series.
And yeah, I think it would even read better. Like I tend to read it in chunks, like at least 4-issue chunks, and I think it would read better in trade, because there's a big mythical story being told, you know.
Right.
And from month to month, if you read a lot, you might forget little things, but if you read it in chunks, it makes a lot more sense and flows better.
Yeah, I mean, I've actually, right now, the only thing I'm buying in single issues is Valiant. And I like them because they do the really detailed recap pages.
Yeah.
So if I forget what's going on, I can, you know, jog my memory that way. So.
Yeah, I like recaps because I don't read them unless I forget. Like, I like the Marvel recaps.
Mm-hmm.
In case I forget or don't read something for like 6 months, then I can pretty much get into the situation.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of wish DC would do that, but.
Yeah, me too.
They don't, and they assume that you're reading from issue to issue because they don't do a lot of backtracking either.
Right. But I mean, even if you are issue to issue, there's still a month in between, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily have to read the recaps word for word, but it saves you from sort of having to remember what's going on while you're reading the first few pages. Instead, you can sort of scan the recap, be fully on board, and know what happened, you know, as soon as you read the first panel, you know? So, I don't know. I don't know what the reasons are, but yeah, I like that Valiant does it. You know, they're doing a good job.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of across the board, that company.
Well, I want to thank Gail and Amy for the questions and
definitely
for the middle segment. And this has been Geek Brunch Retrocast episode 21.
21. And we're legal, baby.
Yeah. And you can find us at geekbrunchpodcast.com. And we're still on Forum for Geeks, although I'm delinquent on posting episodes there. But I'm usually within one or two. And you can get a hold of us by Twitter by saying, hey, @MythMakingETC, what's going on? or at Mike Myers Brunch. And also we have a Facebook page. If you type in Geek Space Brunch Space Podcast on Facebook and click the like button, you can follow us there and follow all our show threads or anything else that we post. We post covers from all the comics that we review. Mm-hmm. And leave an iTunes review, please. That you can do by going to iTunes and going to your iTunes store, type in Geek Brunch, and leave a review there. That helps us get new listeners and all that good stuff.
Absolutely.
Anything else going on that you want to mention?
Karen and I made breakfast this morning.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I like to call it the Daryl Taylor special. We had scrambled tofu and
oh no. Now he's going to get a pissed and he's going to hang up on the podcast.
Yeah, I think he's made sure that I never show up on the regular Geek Brunch again when you're not there. Because the one time I did, we talked about vegetarianism for half an hour.
You had scrambled tofu? What the hell's that?
It's pretty nasty. Pretty literal. Most of the flavor all comes from all the spices. Like, I mean, you crumble up the tofu, but then you put all these different, like, turmeric and, like, all and garlic and all that. It's a really good mix of spice. You know, so that's
so you don't really eat real food. You eat spices. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I eat like basically I eat like pieces of sponge that soak up flavors. You might be more on board with what we had with it, which was I chopped up a whole bunch of sweet potatoes, and and then we baked those covered in Cajun spices.
Ah,
that's really good. I mean, I like the combination of sweet potatoes with spiciness.
Yeah.
So I had to
and a nice slice of bacon.
Yeah. No, but normally we have veggie sausage, but they were all out of veggie sausage at the supermarket. Daryl must have swooped in and bought them all. What happened there? But So it's been a while since we actually like made breakfast, so just having cereal or something.
Well, that's nice.
Oh. Yeah. So, there you go. There's some brunch in the Geek Brunch.
There you go. Retro. You can let that stuff, you don't even have to refrigerate that stuff. It could be retro from 1970.
Yeah, actually, the tofu that we used, I got it for free with some comics I bought back in the 80s. I just it's like wine, you know.
It ages well.
Just been aging it in the cellar since then, next to, you know, Spawn number 3.
Well, sponges usually last forever, unless you like clean the bathroom with them. So.
Yeah, that's what we do with our tofu. With our backup tofu, like once with our backup tofu.
Yeah.
If we don't eat it.
Yeah, we'll use it to wipe things.
Yeah. In the toilet. That's the advantage. It's like I eat the tofu and then it cleans the toilet on the way out.
Yeah, it's like it's really environmental friendly.
Exactly. Eco. I have eco-friendly waste products.
There you go.
I'm a one-man machine.
So
on that note,
did you say that you wouldn't be available in 2 weeks, or how does that work?
Or you would be? No, now that we recorded this week instead, I am available. Yeah, it was just next Sunday it won't be.
Okay.
But now that we're recording today, yeah, I'm good.
All righty. Well,
back on schedule.
Have a good week, and I will talk to you soon.
Thanks, you too.
All right, bye-bye.
Adios.
problem, Lincoln.
Yeah.